Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1055, interview number 24 with Jim DiEugenio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on February 5th of the year 2019, and yet again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to bring back to our airwaves Jim DiEugenio, the author of, among other titles, Destiny Betrayed, about the JFK assassination and New Orleans DA Jim Garrison's investigation of same. Jim, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Good evening, Dave.
In our last interview, we were talking about the Vietnam policy that JFK pursued, how that was reversed by LBJ, and we're going to continue with discussion of how, in effect, our destiny was betrayed with these profound reversals of foreign policy. I wonder if you would just briefly, for the benefit of some who have not heard that interview, review the NSAMs 263, 273, 288, and how LBJ had structured the escalation, and then we'll talk about his deception during the 1964 election.
Yes, the NSAM 263 was Kennedy's memorandum that he was going to go ahead and begin his withdrawal program in December of 1963 from Vietnam. All right, when Johnson takes over within just a few days, that all gets altered. All right, and the advisors do not come home. And in fact, Johnson actually added hundreds of advisors. But most of all, he authorizes the United States to get directly involved with something called O-Plan 34A. And those patrols, which went up the coast of North Vietnam, that is eventually what provoked the Gulf of Tonkin incident. But before that, Johnson had signed off on NSAM 288, which mapped out kind of an air war over North Vietnam, which had been unheard of during the Kennedy assassination, during the Kennedy administration. And so when the Gulf of Tonkin allegedly happened, Johnson pulls out NSAM 288 and he begins his bombing campaign against the North, right? And so that eventually escalates, right? But during the actual campaign of 1964, Johnson keeps it on ice, all right? He doesn't have an all-out, you know, attack against the North yet, all right? He keeps it kind of small scale. He adds about like 30,000 American troops to protect the air base at Da Nang, all right? But he campaigns as a peace candidate, if you can believe it. There, we seek no wider war. I will not send American boys to do a job that Asian boys should be doing, all that stuff. He ridicules Goldwater as being the war candidate, okay? In your guts, you know he's nuts, all right? That kind of thing, all right? And this, of course, more or less, buries Goldwater at the polls. And in fact, what had been happening that entire 1964, Johnson had been setting up plans to do exactly what he said he wasn't going to do. That is, to expand the war, you know, massively, you know, by both land, sea, and air, okay, against North Vietnam. And so once he's elected, he's inaugurated in January of 64, the big buildup begins in February of 1964. All right, and by March of 65. And by March of 1965, all right, the United States has about 100,000 combat troops, which Kennedy was never going to commit. And it begins to build up this Operation Rolling Thunder, the massive air war against the North. And by the time it's over, there's going to be more bomb tonnage dropped over Indochina than there was in all of Europe during World War II. All right? Now, this peaks out in 1967, 1968, with 540,000 American combat troops in Vietnam. 540,000. All right? And when it's all over, you're going to have a total dead, and by the way, I got this count from a British medical journal that actually, unlike these other estimates, they actually went to Vietnam, knocked on doors, interviewed families, and then asked them after the war, did anybody die by, you know, setting foot on a landmine or something like that? When it's all over, which is 1975, you're going to have 1.2 million military casualties. That means South Vietnam, North Vietnam, and Americans. And you're going to have a grand total of about 4.1 million, that's combined civilian and military. Now, if you go ahead and add in Cambodia, which I don't think you cannot do, all right, and the estimates there, about 1 million to 2 million dead, you've really got the equivalent of American Holocaust there in Indochina. Anywhere from 5 to 6 million dead because of what happened after Kennedy was assassinated. All right?
And we really have to underscore, I think, that this was not some improvised or reactionary policy by LBJ. This was a conscious reversal of JFK's Vietnam policy and the escalation that was presented to us as being reactionary, that is, in response to the North Vietnamese attacks on our defenseless destroyers out in international waters, blah, 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 was in fact a predetermined and very cynical program that of aggression that was implemented very consciously and step by step under the electoral guise of LBJ as a peace candidate.
Yes, yes. Johnson understood exactly what he was going to do as early as, well, a week after he took office. And there was a secret planning committee, all right, that was installed to go ahead and map out what the United States was going to do once Johnson was elected and how they were going to do it, all right. And they even went ahead and mapped out the Gulf of Tonkin resolution 3 months before the Gulf of Tonkin actually happened. That's how pre-planned the whole thing was. It's one of the very most ugly secrets, you know, that came out, you know, through the historical excavation of that period, that just how bad Johnson was on this whole issue. And, I have to say, if you take a look at what Nixon did after Johnson left office, he dropped more bombs on Indochina than Johnson did. And it's not really close, by about a million tons. He directly expanded the war into much further than Johnson did, into Cambodia and Laos, therefore causing even more fatalities and even more collateral damage. And the excursion to Cambodia, of course, first took out Sihanouk, then it took out Lon Nol, and it brought the rise to power of the Khmer Rouge, who supervised one of the worst genocides in the world after World War II.
Indeed.
Anywhere from 1 million to 2 million people dead because of the rise of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia.
The storied killing fields. Jim, you were talking about Richard Nixon, and, of course, following the tumultuous 1968 campaign, which saw the clear Democratic candidate Robert Kennedy assassinated, and he had been talking about reopening the investigation into his brother's murder after he got elected. We spoke about that. You mentioned that the brilliant comedian Mort Saul was at a gig, and his wife at the time, China Lee, was being peppered by questions from Robert Kennedy about what Jim Garrison was coming up with in New Orleans. The 1968 election, however, even after Robert Kennedy was assassinated, is worth commenting on. We observed in our last interview that Robert McNamara was actually not the hawk that he has come to be seen as having been, but rather was something of a prisoner of policy at the time. In fact, you write that LBJ actually tried him to disown or disavow the notion that JFK was going to pull out of Vietnam, which obviously he was. Something I did not know until I read your book was that LBJ froze out Hubert Humphrey from Vietnam consultation because Hubert Humphrey, who eventually ran against Nixon and lost in part because he was perceived as a hawk as well, was an opponent of LBJ's Vietnam policies. I wonder if you would develop that for us briefly.
Yeah, that's true. That's correct. I think this occurred in 1965 when Johnson was really trying to push the whole escalation issue forward, you know, and Humphrey was taken aback by this and was wondering, you know, is this what we really want to do? Is it really worth all this? And he wrote Johnson a memo with words to that effect. And Johnson got very upset, and he banned Humphrey from any future meetings on the Vietnam thing, and beyond that, he actually put some surveillance on Humphrey to make sure that he wasn't leaking his disagreement to the media. See, that's how monomaniacal that LBJ was on this whole Vietnam issue, and that's the kind of loyalty that he demanded from everybody. And if you didn't disagree with him, well, that was going to be a liability for you, you know, and your access to him in the White House.
He actually had Hubert Humphrey surveilled to make sure that his dissent about the Vietnam War would not be leaked.
Right.
That is amazing. These are events that I lived through. And I remember the 1968 campaign and the vitriol that was directed against Hubert Humphrey for being a war candidate, etc. And in fact, he was not, which is, it's remarkable to contemplate the gap between political reality, as you have documented it, and the public perception, which was very, very, very different. Jim, you were alluding to policies, overlapping policies that LBJ had pursued in two of the other countries that came out of French Indochina. I wonder if you would detail for us what JFK had worked out vis-a-vis Laos, one of those countries, and how that changed under LBJ.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
If you couldn't believe this, when Kennedy was coming into office, Eisenhower actually told him that he thought Laos was more worrisome than Vietnam was. And also, if we had to go to war to anywhere in Indochina, he said it's probably going to be Laos. Now, if you know anything about Laos, there's even less in Laos that's worth going to war for than there was in Vietnam. Okay, I mean, you know, what's there worth fighting for as a matter of national security in Laos? And the answer is there wasn't anything. And by the way, that's exactly what Kennedy told Nixon when he was talking about this with him. He goes, I just don't see, you know, I just don't see what is worth going to war for in Laos. I just don't understand it, you know. And what happened is that even though Kennedy felt that way, there were other people in his advisory staff that really did want him to go ahead and commit American forces into Laos. Well, Kennedy resisted this, all right? And so what he did instead is he decided to make one of the whole Great White Fleet things, you know, like, you know, float the I think it was the 7th Fleet, off the coast, you know, and issue a warning to the Russians that you better not escalate anything over here, okay? And so that was enough to go ahead and convince the Russians to stick out, to stay out. And so what happened then was that there was a proposal for a neutralization plan in Laos. And so Kennedy agreed to go ahead and send a representative, who ended up being Averell Harriman, to this meeting, all right? I think it was in Geneva. And it worked out that the country is going to be neutralized. That is, that there was going to be no communist domination, and that there would be a coalition government, all right? And that's what Kennedy wanted there, all right? He did not want to have any kind of shooting war in Laos, all right? And so I think that was agreed to in, I think, 1962, I think in the fall of 1962. Unfortunately, like everything else, almost everything else, you know, it didn't last very long after Kennedy's assassination. And what happened is that once Johnson and then Nixon decided that you had to fight the Vietnam War by going into Cambodia and Laos to hinder the resupply effort, then this is expanded, you know, to the point that you had all kinds of cross-border operations, which upset the status quo. And it culminated, of course, with Nixon actually invading both Cambodia and Laos. And whatever that the neutralization plan that Kennedy envisioned ended up collapsing under that kind of unremittent military pressure. And what happened in Laos is that you had the CIA essentially started, in order to finance the increasing war, okay, they started a massive drug trade, all right? I think it's called the Golden Triangle, okay, which I think, who's that famous author?
Alfred McCoy.
What's his name?
Alfred McCoy.
Yeah, Alfred McCoy. He wrote a book called The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, right?
Absolutely. And a good follow-up volume was Henry Kruger's The Great Heroin Coup, which not only incorporates
right.
a lot of that material, but then takes a lot of the people you have spoken about in connection with J.M. Wave and the dirty wars against Castro, and they picked up a lot of this themselves. It may even have involved some of that, Sergio Arcacha Smith, who was involved with some of the contraband
right.
smuggling. But so, yes, it just one of the major components of the Southeast Asian escalation was a tremendous drug trafficking operation to finance covert operations in Laos and to an extent Vietnam as well.
I think Kruger actually says that Marshall Key was a part of it, the second in command in South Vietnam.
That was actually, I don't recall Kruger saying that, but that was in Alfred McCoy's book. Yes, he was in charge of the South Vietnamese Air Force and also was the vice president under Nguyen Van Thieu, and was deeply involved in the heroin trade. You may remember, too, Jim, there was a picture that came out during the 1968 Tet Offensive, and we're now actually at the Lunar New Year. The Year of the Pig was ushered in today. The North Vietnamese and South Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, launched a major offensive, and in Saigon, there was a famous picture after the the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong forces were turned down. General Luan, or Luan, L-O-A-N, who was one of the top security officials in Saigon, executed a Viet Cong prisoner with a single shot to the head from a snub-nosed 38. It was a very famous picture, and actually there was he was also one of the principals involved in the drug trade in South Vietnam.
Oh, okay. Well, that's something I didn't know.
Yeah, he was one of the people. I guess the original plan had been put together during the French Indochina War by Colonel Roger Tronquier, who saw the opium trade as a good vehicle not only for financing covert operations, but securing a cadre who would be loyal to the money and the traffic of the heroin trade. And that was then carried forward by the U.S. That's one of those iconic pictures that came out of the Vietnam War. It was brutal, but we weren't told that the guy who was doing that was also a major drug trafficker. And an interesting thing, the point being that after Kennedy had established a policy of neutrality for Laos, that too was cast to the wind by LBJ and CIA Paul.
Right. And so what happened is that there ended up being a tremendous amount of violence in Laos. I think it went on until the mid-1970s, bombing campaign after bombing campaign after bombing campaign, you know. And finally, the CIA pulled out, all right, and it ended up being from a neutralist government to a communist-leaning government in Laos after the country had gone through, you know, a tremendous amount of, you know, pretty much senseless and useless violence that had kind of put the country almost back to the Stone Age, you know, and it ended up being a kind of, you know, I don't know how else you say it, it's pretty much a disastrous policy. You know, the whole thing about Indochina, I think you can say, you know, ended up being a disaster after Kennedy's assassination. The only good thing about it is that today, and this is a real problem I had with that, I don't know if you watched that 18-hour mediocrity by Ken Burns that PBS put on about the Vietnam War.
I don't watch television at all, Jim. I don't have one in the house.
Well,
so
then
no.
you'll stay smarter. Yeah. Okay. Then. But I had to watch it because I reviewed it. And when he got to the end of the series, he kind of tried all the films, the contemporary films and pictures, tried to portray that today, you know, Vietnam is still kind of an agricultural country. Anybody who's listening to this program, all you have to do is go to your computer and type in Ho Chi Minh City, which is the name of Saigon today, and you'll see that Ho Chi Minh City is a thriving metropolis today. It has a skyline, you know, like Chicago, all right? And if you go ahead and go to a menu, a pull-down menu thing, you'll see things like McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, etc. All right?
Whether that actually constitutes progress is something
all I'm saying is that it's not a backward country at all.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm just saying that.
It's a very much a modern kind of city, all right? And I think the reason he did not put those things in there, because the obvious question would have been, well, wait a minute. If we wouldn't have fought that stupid war there, this all would have happened sooner without 4 million people dead.
It's an interesting thing to contemplate what would have happened. There was an article in The Economist about post-Vietnam War of Vietnam, and they interviewed a number of people. One was an actual veteran of the North Vietnamese Army, and he described how two of his children were horribly malformed because of the Agent Orange. And just said, nobody ever asks me about the war. You know, he just, it's a non-subject, apparently, at least for his series of associations. The point being, though, that in Laos and in Cambodia, the Kennedy policy was not only stood on its head, but with lethal results for millions of people. And it is, you know, one of the major tragedies. It's also interesting, too, that some of the same people from J.M. Wave, people like Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins, also assumed prominent positions in Southeast Asia at around that same time. So
right. Shackley was the chief of station.
Yep. So that the continuity from the CIA's wars against Castro, with their attendant corruption, obviously a series of events that heavily overlaps the JFK assassination. The anti-Castro effort was a major focal point of Jim Garrison's investigation. Then, to an extent, shifts to Southeast Asia after Kennedy's Vietnam War policy is stood on its head and completely flushed down the toilet by LBJ, with results that we have spoken about. That was by no means the only place where JFK's very prescient understanding of the political dynamics of former colonial territories and their desire to be modern nations, not necessarily caught up in the Cold War dynamics. We spoke about Edmund Gullion, who was the in charge of the State Department's contingent in what was then French Indochina. He counseled JFK as he was running for the Senate that the French would not win Indochina. He was quite correct. He then, as you mentioned, became Kennedy's ambassador to the Congo. If you would review for us, Jim, JFK's understanding of the Congo, what was going on near the ascension of Patrice Lumumba, the attempted secession of Katanga province, and then what happened after JFK was killed with the Congo and what happened to his people.
Okay. This is a real, I believe this is one of the most underreported stories in the entire Kennedy administration. And I've been trying to do my best to give it some space and some opportunity for people to be informed of it, because I think it's so very important in so many different ways. What you had in Congo was another example of European colonialism. In this case, it was Belgium. And they had been in Congo for generations, and it was one of the most brutal colonizations in the annals of world history. And in fact, it got so bad that the Belgian parliament took it away from King Leopold. What happened is that finally, due to the resistance by the native peoples in Congo, they got an agreement to have a withdrawal by Belgium. And one of the people who was instrumental in getting that agreement was Patrice Lumumba. I think he was like 34 years old or something at the time. And he was a very dynamic speaker, charismatic leader, who wanted Africa for the Africans.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Belgium played a kind of dirty trick on Lumumba, who had been elected to be the prime minister, the new prime minister of the country. They decided to pull out very abruptly, okay, but leaving a strategic amount of military people there, knowing that because there was no real transition, that things would fall apart and that Belgium would have to go back in, all right? And this is precisely what happened, all right? Once the Congolese forces began to collapse, all right, the Belgians went ahead and dropped thousands of paratroopers into Congo. Lumumba now began looking for help, all right? And he went to the United States, who didn't want anything to do with him. And in fact, Eisenhower signed an order to Allen Dulles to begin the plot to kill him, all right? And he went to the Russians, who agreed to send in supplies, which of course made him look even worse in the eyes of Washington, D.C. The only guy who was willing to send in help was Dag Hammarskjöld from the UN, all right? But it took a long time for him to send in the help, which really discouraged Lumumba.
He was Secretary General of the UN at that time. Go ahead, Jim.
Right, right. All right, and so to make a long story a little bit shorter, Lumumba was marked out for assassination by the CIA, and what happened is that they decided not to kill him themselves, but to go ahead and capture him and send him over to the breakaway colony of Katanga, which the Belgians had already planned on separating from Congo, knowing that Katanga was by far the most wealthy mineral resource area in the whole country. All right, so they had sponsored a breakaway by that area from Leopoldville. Okay.
This, by the way, was a Congo. This was a colonial gambit of that had been used for a long time by some of the European colonial powers, which was to effect the secession, not just European, of an area that had key mineral or strategic importance, and then set that up as a separate principality. Sullivan and Cromwell helped to arrange the creation of the state of Panama out of Colombia, specifically so they could build the Panama Canal. It's also taken place elsewhere as well. So this is a gambit that is a tried and true one. And Katanga province, again, very mineral rich, and the Belgians were working to have that secede so they could basically harvest the wealth.
Right, right. And so what happened is Lumumba was then sent to Katanga, and under the auspices of the Belgians, the Katanga government went ahead and killed him by firing squad. All right. This was not let out, okay, until after Kennedy was inaugurated. And Kennedy did not realize what had happened until almost a month after Lumumba was killed. All right. Within several months after that, in September, what happens? Hammarskjöld and the UN forces are in the thick of this thing, trying to keep Congo together, free from imperialism, and one country. Then, in September of 1961, he's killed. The ostensible reason being that it's a plane accident. I think anybody who's investigating that whole case up to this day understands that his plane was sabotaged, and he was murdered to get him out of the way.
Jim, in that regard, I'd like to, before we continue with Hammarskjöld, David Talbot in The Devil's Chessboard has opined that the actual killing of Lumumba was, the timetable for that was stepped up specifically to get rid of him before Kennedy was inaugurated, because it was feared that his sympathy for Lumumba might interdict plans to eliminate him.
I agree with that.
Yep. And so then Lumumba's gone at the beginning of 61, just before Kennedy is inaugurated. Then in September, Dag Hammarskjöld's plane goes down, killing the UN Secretary General, who was there to try to ameliorate the growing conflict. And that is a story, as we touched on in our last interview, that is Okuwo, the death of Dag Hammarskjöld.
Very briefly, finishing up Congo.
Sure.
What's amazing about this is that Kennedy essentially took up where Hammarskjöld had left off. They had a silent agreement, him and Hammarskjöld, that they were not going to let Congo back under the claw of imperialism. All right. And that just came out like a couple years ago. And you would expect that after your partner is dead and gone, actually murdered, okay, would you still honor the agreement? Well, Kennedy did. He essentially did this by himself for 2 years. Okay, he went ahead and kept Congo unified, all right, kept it and eventually crushed the Katanga uprising. It was Kennedy who cast a deciding vote to go ahead and have a UN army go in and crush the Katanga rebellion. All right? And so even after that, he didn't give up, even though the UN wanted to give up at that point.
After the death of Hammarskjöld, go ahead.
He went to New York, and I think this is September of 1963, all right, and said, we can't let this thing go now. If for no other reason than in the memory of Dag Hammarskjöld, okay, we have to complete this job. And he's been sanctioned another year. All right, and then, of course, what happens, like we've been, the whole theme of this show has been, once Kennedy is killed, then everything goes down the drain in Congo. All right, the they begin to go ahead and say that the leftist rebellion that's taking place is being sponsored from China. All right, the Johnson sends in the CIA. Okay. They bring in all these Operation 40 guys to fly these missions to crush the last followers of Patrice Lumumba. And Mobutu ends up taking over the government, and he ends up bringing in soldiers, if you can believe it, from Rhodesia.
Okay. Sure, sure.
You know, and he ends up taking control. And that was it. That was it.
By the way, Jim, Operation 40 is something we've spoken about in our earlier interviews. That was in connection with the covert operations against Castro, and was basically appears to have been a program to assassinate any Cuban nationals who did not favor basically a return of the Batista style quasi-colonial regime in Cuba. The point is, these
They were the real hardcore guys within the Bay of Pigs invasion force.
Killers, basically.
Yes.
And so they were then shipped over to the Congo. And Joseph Mobutu, tell us briefly about him and what he did there after the reversal of Kennedy's policy.
Mobutu was supposed to be the guy in charge of the security forces for Cyril Abdullah, who was the guy who followed Lumumba into office, all right? But once the idea was to go ahead and kill Lumumba, then Mobutu was one of the guys at the CIA tried to get to take part in the plot. So he was immediately compromised, you know, by the agency. All right. And so then when Kennedy was killed, the Pentagon and the CIA, you know, ended up backing Mobutu. Abdullah was this is what happened specifically. Guillain quit. When he saw what was happening there after Kennedy was killed, Guillain quit his job as ambassador. All right. Then Abdullah was retired. Okay. And that is how Mobutu came to power. And he essentially, it was essentially a one-man fascist regime. He was, as they say, the American chosen strong man to keep order, all right, and to sack the country, you know, for the Western interests, especially Belgium and England, all right? And he stayed in power for, 30 years or something like that?
Decades.
You know, and today, you know, Congo is a mess today. Congo is classified as a failed state. You know, there's a bunch of warlords, you know, and as Jonathan Quitney wrote in his book Endless Enemies, which is a very good chapter on Congo there, you know, the sad story is that Congo was a democracy. That was an election. That was a fair election. It was a constitutional government. And that the United States went ahead, subverted the democratic process, overthrew the constitutional government, and took part in the assassination of the first democratic elected leader in sub-Saharan Africa. All right? That's the truth of what the United States did in Congo. And that's why I think it's so important.
Yep. And the couple of points of the Congo had been a very wealthy country, and Mobutu basically pimped off the country to Western corporations, and he took a very generous pimping fee for himself. He became fabulously wealthy. And it is interesting, Jim, to contemplate the big lie. One of the people who handled Mobutu was none other than Paul Manafort from Manafort, Black, and Stone. He was Donald Trump's campaign manager. Manafort, Black, and Stone also, Stone is Roger Stone, the Roy Cohn protege. And among Manafort's other clients were Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines, Jonas Savimbi and Umipa in Angola, and Joseph Mobutu. I've done extensive programming. I haven't got time to go into it now, but he was not a Russian agent. What he was doing was successfully teasing Ukraine from the Russian orbit into the West. But now we're being told, well, he was a Russian agent, blah, 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 blah. It is like he was no more a Russian agent than Lee Harvey Oswald was a Marxist Marine. You know, one of the reasons, Mobutu was one of his clients, you know, and he ain't a Russian agent. You know, one of the reasons why I am taking the time to really stretch out with your very important book is to teach people, particularly younger people, not only the dimensions of the big lie, but the dynamics of it. We're being handed these things, well, this is this, and this is that, and this happened, and that happened. And yet, the truth is fundamentally different. I actually did a program where I alluded to Manafort. I called him Lee Harvey Manafort, because he's a U.S. intelligence officer of longstanding, and he's being left out in the cold now and saying, well, but he's a Russian agent. You know, again, he's no more a Russian agent than Lee Harvey Oswald was. And so it's
right, these, I agree.
You know, when we're told whether they're weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, so we've got to, you know, to go in there lest there be a mushroom cloud, a la Condoleezza Rice. And we see these things. People really need to be alert to the big lie, not only that there are big lies, but how they tend to be serialized. And as I've said so many times in these interviews, your dissection of how they smeared and professionally destroyed Jim Garrison and misrepresented his heroic efforts, you know, infiltrating individual spies into his office, having them steal documents, then coordinating them with the intelligence services. Then they're coordinated with the media hatchet men who work with the intelligence services. Then those are all coordinated with Clay Shaw's defense team, which in turn is coordinated with the Department of Justice. And this goes through decades. We see Richard Billings, or Dick Billings, and Robert Blakey, two of the hatchet men journalists who went after Garrison for Life magazine in 67. And then they turn up as two of the principal people on the House Select Committee after Richard Sprigg has gotten the Garrison treatment. So I think the tremendous importance of Destiny Betrayed, it shows us how destiny is betrayed, and it really gives us, I think, if one takes the time to do this, and it's, again, that's why I'm stretching out here, it gives us a clear picture, an analysis of how the big lie is put together and the nature of the ongoing lying. And I think it's important for all people. I think it is particularly important for younger people who are being handed all of this stuff and told, William, yep, and this is it. This is the way it is, kids, you know. And unfortunately, it is not the way it is.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
So, once again, the Congo, another place where JFK's understanding of the post-colonial dynamics and the desire for these countries to not only thrive but to remain aloof from the Cold War dynamics that were enveloping the world, that was reversed after JFK was killed and LBJ got in. Another country that you have written about, Jim, and that is Indonesia. I wonder if you would tell us about JFK's policies vis-a-vis Indonesia, a little bit about the dynamics of Indonesia after it gained independence, and then tell us what happened again after Kennedy was killed and LBJ came in.
Well, this is another story that I believe does not get anywhere near enough attention, because it's so incredibly important. What happened in Indonesia in 1965 was touched upon in that Mel Gibson movie, The Year of Living Dangerously. That managed to give a little bit more exposure. But it's not until recently that the truth has come out about what happened in Indonesia that took the lives of, the estimates I've seen, anywhere from 400,000 to 800,000 people, all right, in the overthrow of Ahmad Sukarno. Sukarno was the leader of Indonesia from the time of the end of World War II up until the 1965 overthrow, all right? And he was really another guy who was really more of a nationalist than he was a communist. You had to classify him as anything. You know, he'd probably classify him as a socialist, all right? And so he wanted to actually do something for the people of Indonesia. But he ran into a problem when he sponsored in 1955, he sponsored a conference for what was called back then the non-allied countries. All right. In other words, countries in the emerging third world who did not want to be associated directly with either Russia or the United States. They simply wanted to do what was good for them. And there were many, many countries who attended that meeting, including Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt, as one example of a non-aligned country. And John Foster Dulles didn't like this. All right? So him and his brother Alan, who was director of the CIA, plotted to overthrow Sukarno in 1957, 1958. And it was unsuccessful. All right? There's a debate there about whether it was really meant to succeed or whether or not it was really a ploy to concentrate the military more centrally for the real attempt that was supposed to happen a few years later. All right, so when Kennedy becomes president in 1961, he asked Alan Dulles for the report on the attempted overthrow of Sukarno, because there's a pilot still there that the Indonesians had shot down, and Kennedy wants to get him back. And so Dulles gives him a redacted report. But isn't that hysterical? I mean, I can see me getting a redacted report, Dave. I can see you getting a redacted report. I can't see the President of the United States getting a redacted report.
Well, I think it's indicative of how the power structure in Washington, D.C., or maybe even the suburbs such as Langley, was determined at that point. The president was deemed among the people who would eyes only, not the president.
All right. And so what happens is that he can still make out, because he told, I think it was Kenny O'Donnell, words to the effect, no wonder Sukarno doesn't like us. We tried to overthrow his government. So he decides to go ahead and send his brother as his emissary to Sukarno. And in agreement for giving him back this pilot, Kennedy was going to help Sukarno get back the colony, the island of Westerion. Westerion, because the Netherlands wanted to hold on to that. They didn't want to give it back to Sukarno. All right. And so they managed to go ahead. Kennedy maneuvered it to a point that they were going to go ahead and give it back to Sukarno. Sukarno was overjoyed. But there was one thing here that, unlike Congo, people weren't aware of, except a very few people, including Alan Dulles. Westerion had either as much or more raw materials, valuable raw materials in it, than Katanga did. All right, I'm talking about gold, copper, silver, and petroleum. All right? And when Kennedy was leaving off, before he died, Kennedy was actually helping Sukarno make deals to nationalize certain industries, all right? And Kennedy was insisting that it be a 60-40 split in favor of Indonesia. And when Kennedy is killed, all the forces that were opposed to this, okay, the granting of Westerion back to Sukarno, the deals in favor of the Indonesians, again, they massed together under the auspices of Lyndon Johnson's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, And within a few months, they made a proposal that the CIA begin to set up a plan to go ahead and cause the overthrow of Sukarno's government. And I have to say, everything that from what I've read, the CIA considered this their masterpiece of covert action. All right. They knew they could not go after Sukarno himself, all right, because he was so popular. So what they did, they set up a group that they said was trying to overthrow Sukarno. All right. They called it the Council of the Generals. All right. And they would then use that group aborting their plan, okay, to overthrow Sukarno as an excuse to go after the Communist Party, which was a big backer of Sukarno. They would say that it was the communists, you know, who were really backing this move, which, of course, doesn't make any sense, but it doesn't matter in the hysteria that broke out. The latest research on this by a guy named Greg Polgrain, who's coming out with a book, I think, this fall. It's always been a mystery as to how this was done, because it was so ingenious and so clever. The truth is going to turn out that the guy who ended up being the new fascist dictator, Suharto, was actually a part of the plan. That's how he knew what was going to happen. That's how he manipulated it so that he would come out on top. All right? And I've had the chance to work with Greg Polgrain, and I've had a chance to look at his work, and I think it's going to be a real advance to our understanding of what happened in the year of Living Dangerously, 1965, with the overthrow of Sukarno. And what happened in Indonesia, the same thing happened in Congo. Suharto went ahead, took over the government. Those 60-40 splits ended up being 90-10 splits, this time for the company. 10% is a lot of money if it's going to one person. And that's what happened, okay? And Indonesia ended up being an overall grindingly poor country, just like Congo, once Sukarno was disposed of. So you had the same thing that happened in Congo that repeated itself in Indonesia.
Suharto,
believe me, I don't know how many instances we have to go through. This was not a coincidence.
Sure. Suharto was pimping off Indonesia as Mobutu had been pimping off Congo to the corporations.
Correct.
We'll take up the wind up with Indonesia, and we have Cuba. A lot of things to discuss in what I think will be our last interview, Jim, but we've got just a couple of minutes left. If you would tell people about your website, the opening for a webmaster where they can get not only Destiny Betrayed, but JFK The Evidence Today and Black Op Radio.
All right. The website that I edit and publish is called KennedysandKing.com. And if you go there, you can get punched through. You can get both my books, the most current one, which is called The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today. And this book we're discussing, Destiny Betrayed, the second edition. My very fine webmaster is retiring. And so if anybody has those skills with HTML and Joomla, please get in contact with me through the website, and hopefully I can find somebody to replace him on a voluntary basis. Thursday nights, I'm a semi-regular guest on Leno Sanek's Black Op Radio out of Vancouver.
So there is where you can learn more, both via the Internet and Internet radio. And if there is someone with the requisite skills who would like to lend their talents to the effort. Contact Jim through the Kennedys and King website. This concludes For the Record program number 1055, interview number 24 with Jim DeEugenio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on February 5th of the year 2019. For Jim DeEugenio, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.